Would you please give him a warm welcome, Dr. Daniel Jordan.
Thank you, David. And good evening, everybody. Let me add my welcome to his. For an evening which will have three parts, I always think people feel more comfortable if they have a little road map and know where they're going. This is the road map. First, Nancy and I want to paint for you a context within which to comprehend the kind of beginning it is when one becomes a Baha'i. And secondly, we would like to meet up here and greet friends and guests of the Baha'is and talk a little bit more intimately about what it means to become a Baha'i and what one can expect when one becomes a Baha'i in this incredible juncture of human history where there seems to be so many marvelous things able to happen to us, yet we seem to be teetering right on the brink of disaster. A moment, to be sure, where everyone on this planet is faced with decisions about what to do with his or her own life in this extraordinary age. Then thirdly, we will have a period of fellowship and refreshments. Now for the context. So far, as astronomers and physicists know, this universe, governed by these particular forms of laws, as we seem to be discovering and have been discovering them for some time, seems to have, according to them, come into being some 20 billion years ago. And in the course of that coming into being, there were billions of galaxies. And there was one galaxy called the Milky Way that had billions of stars in it, each a flaming orb, and many of which had planets circulating around them. And in the corner of that Milky Way galaxy, there was one medium-sized sun, our sun, and around it, nine planets, one of which seems to have been a specially precious planet, the planet Earth. So far as we can tell, this precious Earth is around 5 billion years old. In the 1950s, right here in this very city, Dr. Willard Libby won a Nobel Prize for discovering the technique for radiometric dating, a means by which it became possible to tell how old things are. And when we examined the oldest rocks on the Earth, they turned out to be around about 3 billion years old. And when meteorites from outer space that came down to the Earth were examined, they seemed to be no older than 5 billion years old. So by most reckonings, this Earth, we've come to agree on, is about 5 billion years old. Somewhere along 4.5 billion years ago, an extraordinary thing happened. A breakthrough of incredible dimensions. What had been considered inert matter sprang into life. Nobody's quite certain how that happened, but that it happened, there's no doubt. For we are the living proof of it, and everything growing and moving on this wondrous planet of ours. How the action of the sun on the elements here pulled off that bit of magic, that divine magic, will keep the minds of scientists busy to figure out, I suspect, for quite a while. And yet, every step we make to discover more about how it might have happened, the more thrilling and the more fascinating it all becomes, the more awe-inspiring it is, the more it instills within oneself a deep reverence for the ultimate mystery of it all. That's why I suspect the real scientist has the true religious spirit, because daily he is on that cutting edge of the divine mystery in his work, in his efforts to discover how these things happened. Since the time of 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth has gone through many transformations. There have been volcanic activity, tectonic plates have been shifting about, there have been several ice ages, there have been some warm periods, there have been lots of convulsions. And in the course of all of that, life moved on. Ever upward, ever grasping towards new possibilities, creating new forms, proliferating species and subspecies, until the whole earth was filled with a spectacular display of living creatures. And somehow at the apex of that evolutionary thrust came a creature called man. Man has not been around very long, at least in this present form. He's a relative newcomer on the scene, just a few million years. And what we've managed to accomplish, good and bad, in just that short space of time, is truly mind-boggling. We are on the brink of something magnificent and incredible to behold, in terms of the things we could be achieving, while at the same time we stand on the same brink of extinguishing ourselves. Because we have the power right under our thumb to blast ourselves right off the face of this planet, to well-nigh carbonize it, to bring our cities down, and to face evolution with the embarrassing prospect of having to try it all over again, hoping this time maybe to create somebody a little more responsible. Don't you think it would be an awful embarrassment for evolution if it had to confess that the dinosaurs, who roamed on this planet for 125 million years and sort of kept order in things, did relatively well compared to 2 to 3 million years that man roamed about on this planet. In just the last 6 to 10,000 years, extraordinary developments have taken place, largely because of man's consciousness, his ability to entertain possibilities, his wonder, his curiosity, his perpetual seeking, what you might call a spark of divine unrest that propels him always to seek out new ways of becoming, to pursue new destinies. And above all, a consciousness that will not let him rest, a consciousness that says, I'm different from everybody else. Everything in the universe I seem to be different from, and therefore I want to know how I'm related to everything else, all other creatures, all other people, and yes, even the ultimate unknowable mystery underlying the order of the universe, I want to know how I am related to that too. That pressure, that drive to entertain possibilities, is part of the holy, the holiness in man. I feel it is the divinity in man. keeps him pushing, keeps him seeking. So all of us here, whether we like it or not, at some point in time, and some more than others, feel an urge to place ourselves in touch, in relationship to the ultimate unknowable essence underlying the universe. And because that spark has always been with us, religion has always been a part of man's cultural experience. In these last 6 to 10,000 years, that same drive, that same push has delivered to us many remarkable achievements, not the least of which was the development of articulate speech, the ability to let one thing stand for something else. What that didn't open up for us: new insights, new ways of expressing affection, new ways of quarreling. Everything seems to have a good and a bad side to it. We found out how to control fire and make use of it. And we found out that we wouldn't have to run around picking berries and digging roots, because certain plants give off things called seeds. If you plant them, things come up. You can harvest what comes up. And you don't have to run around anymore. So we domesticated plants. And we domesticated animals. Then we discovered iron. Then we discovered bronze. Then we invented a variety of tools. Then we discovered the wheel. We made boats. We made all kinds of tools. And lo and behold, we discovered the alphabet. Or somehow it evolved. And in the wake of all of that came hundreds of other things. There was the idea that man's mind could penetrate mysteries and make discoveries and could create inventions. And in the wake of that, we have so many inventions now, we couldn't even begin to list them. I don't even know if they are even listed in one spot on this planet. I doubt it. The microscope, the telescope, the astrolabe, a variety of engines. You can think of the list. It's endless. And a few hundred years ago, that same drive, that same thinking said to a group of men, "The place we're living on, you know, is round. Let's head out over the ocean, see what's there." And lo and behold, they discovered a new world that had already been discovered by somebody else who had come over in the Bering Strait somewhere between 10 and 30,000 years ago and settled what was called the New World. It opened up the possibilities for fresh beginnings, leaving some old things behind, trying out some new things, a new grand experiment in democracy and government, in pulling together people of diverse cultural and racial backgrounds into one unity. And in the sweep of all of that history of the last 6 to 10,000 years, we saw collective unities of human beings emerge, at the core of which was a religious sentiment. The family, then the tribe, then the city-state, then the nation. And now we seem to be on the brink of a new period of evolutionary thrust. And it seems that the whole of mankind is groaning and longing and yearning to witness emerging one single unifying force that will cap off that evolutionary thrust that started with the family and is now laboring with the nation, and push us over the top and enable us to create one unified species living on one beautiful planet in harmony and in peace. Today, in the midst of all of these possibilities and spectacular technological advancements representing untold diverse ways of using various kinds of power and energy. We see the human psyche crumbling under the stress and strain of it all. That all of the great things we have, we've somehow, in part at least, allowed to be used to our own detriment. Listen to these statistics. They're old, which means they're, as my little one used to say, worser now than what I'm saying. An automobile is stolen every 34 seconds. A burglary is committed every 12 seconds around the clock. These are the FBI crime clocks. You know, the FBI has clocks that tick by on these various types of crimes, so they know exactly what's happening per unit time, per category of crime throughout the entire country. Some places are worse than others, you might imagine. There's a robbery every 82 seconds. I saw a more recent one, and I think it's now 56 seconds. Larceny and theft every 7 seconds. There's a violent crime, one every 36 seconds. Murder, one every 27 minutes. That's 53 a day, or 20,000 a year. Forcible rape, one every 10 minutes. There's aggravated assault, one every 76 seconds. In order to escape from that, this country spends $25 billion annually in alcohol to make us numb in the face of it all. We are consuming over 1,500,000 pounds of tranquilizers to keep the brain from fully encountering what the species is doing to its own self. In school, in the United States today, we have 3,500,000 school dropouts who do not know what they are going to do with their talents, their energies, their destinies, their very lives, and who, as you might imagine, are easy prey to organized evil in our society, carrying on all of these things reflected in these statistics. There are 10,000 babies born every day. Nearly 2 million per day for the entire world. 6 out of 10 of those will be malnourished, and the brains will never be fully developed. There will be permanent mental retardation because of inadequate protein intake. In the U.S. alone, the leading killer of infants is accidents. After that, would you believe it? Cancer. It has now gone down that low. You used to think, you know, you had to be 40 or 50. Not so. It is the leading cause of death for children. But I think the real stinger is the fourth leading cause of the death of children. That's homicide. And the murdering usually takes place by a close relative, frequently parents. On top of that, my friends, we are throwing garbage into the atmosphere at an alarming rate. And of all the audiences in the world to say that to, this one needs to have it said to less than anyone else. But we're dumping it into the water, and we're putting it deliberately into the food. Out of 30,000 compounds we've invented and are in the environment around us, we're putting 3,800 of them in our food. Many new diseases are cropping up on the scene. They are the effects of radiation that many people are suffering from. Crime is on the increase. Arson is on the increase. Mental illness is increased. Alcoholism, drug abuse, violence, war, ignorance, superstition, self-mutilation, suicide. The list is long. I've been recently over the last 3 years, undertaking an interesting project, cataloging the 1,000 most pressing problems facing mankind. Because I think the oncoming generation ought to know what these problems are, ought to get themselves organized and equipped with knowledge and ambition and vision and foresight to do something about them. In the midst of all of that, it seems terribly negative and depressing. There's lots of extraordinary, marvelous things going on. And one of our big problems, I do believe, is that we rehearse too much the negative on the news. And that's because some new marvelous discovery by some scientist somewhere may be too technical to really explain easily. It's so much easier and simpler to explain a mass killing than it is the discovery of some new hormone that has tremendous healing powers. But we have a technology now that, were it to become the servant of unity, would transform this planet into a rose garden. Tremendous breakthroughs in transportation, in new energy sources, in communication with our satellites, with laser technology. We've put a man on the moon. We know there's going to be interplanetary travel. We knew we're fiddling with new things in recombinant DNA, and goodness knows what things may come out of that. New techniques for creating new types of food, harvesting the oceans, harvesting new crops on land, planting things sailing around in the air. There are hundreds of ways of using all of this massive amount of new knowledge to serve mankind. The question is, if we are to do it, make all of this power serve the creation of human unity, to serve as a guarantor of our survival and enable us to use those powers and those talents and those abilities and those discoveries to perpetually improve the quality of our lives, we need some magnificent force to emerge in our midst around which we can rally. In the middle of the 19th century, as all of the new scientific advancements were picking up steam, and the new world, so-called, had been settled, wars began, more rumors of wars, and the fragmentation became evident. Yet, in the midst of that incredible fragmentation, stood the historical figure of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith. A figure that stood for the unifying power of the entire human race. He brought teachings that address all of those issues I just rattled off. He articulated principles to tell us how to see things, how to perceive things, how to feel about things, how to behave towards things, the environment, other people. And he designed a governmental order capable of the embodying and acting on those principles, such that we could, bit by bit, reconstruct human life on this planet and turn it into that rose garden. I do not think it is possible for anybody today who is aware of all of these things and a little bit of this context in this history, who wants to remain with his senses intact, I do not think it is possible for a person not to be sensitive to any unifying force that comes close, because it gives the breath of life. It is in the power of unity that evolutionary cycles are carried forward. To feel unified with somebody requires that you feel you can trust. To feel you can trust enables you to feel secure. To feel secure means you can devote your energies to becoming the best that's in you. And you do not have to turn your talents and your resources to being on guard and to tackling somebody else or doing somebody else in. I predict that within the next 20 years, there will not be a soul on this planet who has not come in contact with the unifying force released by the founder of the Baha'i Faith in the latter part of the 19th century. And when that force touches one, one has to make a decision. Shall I connect with it? Shall I run away from it? Shall I pretend it doesn't exist? What shall I do with it? I submit to you, dear friends, that humanity indeed is at the crossroads, and that we can no longer turn to our neighbor and say, well, let him unify the world. I'm going to live it up a little while longer. Because you will find the living up of whatever it is you're living up has death at the end of it. And it may be the sort of death that you will experience for a long time before you actually go in the grave. It will not be the sort of living that is filled with brightness and excitement, bristling with the possibilities of your own becoming and the actualization of your own potentialities. So what we are talking about this evening is, without a shadow of a doubt, the most intimate decision, the most intimate kind of thinking you are ever called upon to do. And that is whether or not to connect with a unifying force that seems to represent the next evolutionary thrust designed to bring together the human species. To be at the crossroads is to feel in some ways that one has arrived. But more than that, it's to have felt and to internally sense that you are at the point of a new beginning. It's a wonderful point to have arrived at. And it's a point that is filled with so many meanings and so much richness. Words are inadequate to even talk about it. But I have some with me tonight who does know how to talk about it. And I'm going to call on Nancy to talk with you about what it means to make that incredible connection. Connection with that divine unifying force destined to pull us all into one family. Nancy.